Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this special transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences on related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. Please visit our website, towardthelight.org, and our media website, towardthelight.info, for more information. I've got a special announcement here. We have just launched the all-new Toward the Light directory. The purpose of this directory is to provide a means for experiencers, researchers, writers, enlightened media, caregivers, loved ones, and more to easily access and connect with one another without having to be a member of a specific group or organization. With such widespread interest in the near-death experience and other related phenomena in recent years, the time is ripe to have such a directory available to the masses on a grand scale so that people can link hands and hearts and work together to help one to feel less alone or isolated, to find information and resources for educational purposes, an abundance of support and resources not restricted to rigid academia or institutions, and so much more. Learn more and sign up now in the Toward the Light directory. For more information, please go to towardthelight.org. Well, this week, I am very pleased to have a wonderful friend and guest back on Toward the Light, has been on Toward the Light before. Let us welcome back Mr. David Icke. Hello, David.
Hello, Julia. How are you?
Well, I'm doing better in some ways, I'm very pleased to say. And it's quite interesting that that we've both been dealing with health challenges and kind of a bit scary also at the same time. And I want to quote the first paragraph on a wonderful article that you wrote called Fearing for a Lifetime, What Doesn't Exist. And it can be found on my website, towardthelight.org, under Near-Death Studies. And this is so spot on. It says, the greatest fear that most people have is fear of the unknown. And the most fundamental unknown is death. How sad it is that lives are blighted by fear of something that doesn't exist. As the Chinese philosopher Chuang Tzu put it, the birth of a man is the birth of his sorrow. The longer he lives, the more stupid he becomes, because his anxiety to avoid unavoidable death becomes more and more acute. What bitterness! He lives for what is always out of reach. His thirst for survival in the future makes him incapable of living in the present. Close quote. Yet there is no death, just a transition from limitation to all possibility. And this is really so true. And we're going to talk about this because it's a very fundamental thing, just as you say. People are very nervous. And I want to share something really quick, David, that happened yesterday. I got an email from someone. A woman had actually left a comment about the radio show. She said, as a result of the love and listening to your radio show, I no longer fear death. Well, yesterday I got an email from a relative of this individual who informed me that she just transitioned. And I thought, oh, goodness me, this is so special that she was not afraid to transition as a result of listening to this show and the information that we share. So I'm very, very moved by this, to say the least. And then somebody asked you just yesterday if you were afraid of dying, and you said absolutely not. And so let's talk about this, because obviously this is something that we all have to face, that we all have got to deal with, and there is a reason why there is no fear. Let's talk about this a bit, David, and maybe if you don't mind repeating a little bit, of course, why you're not afraid of death and what you know about that.
Well, the fear of death comes from ignorance of life, in my view. The ignorance of understanding who and what we really are. And I don't use ignorance in the sense of stupidity, in the sense of uninformed. And the uninformed part comes from the fact that we have a society that is structured to keep the really big answers to the big questions from us, because as I've talked and written at length about over the years, there are a few people, an interbreeding, interconnecting network of family bloodlines that are behind world events and the structure of transnational corporations, governments, and all the rest of it. And what they want, and what they've been working towards literally for thousands of years, is the mass control of humanity, a centralized Orwellian global state. Now, you cannot control what is now billions of people if those billions of people realize that when they look in the mirror, they're looking at something they're experiencing, not at something that they are. And so the process going way back, whether it's the colonial powers of Europe going into Africa and the Americas and Asia and as much as they could in Asia, and seeking to destroy the ancient knowledge of the seers and the shaman that have carried this understanding of reality through the ages, whether it's that, whether it was the Inquisition that used Christianity to destroy the carriers of the knowledge in other parts of the world like Europe. Whatever the background, whatever the means, there was a war, and still is, on this understanding. Because once people realize that they are infinite consciousness and what they are experiencing here is just that, an experience, their point of observation moves from little me to infinite me, and the point from which they observe reality and they observe events in the world and they observe their own experience fundamentally changes. And it changes in a way that makes people impossible to control individually, let alone en masse. So the destruction of this understanding of what is life, what is reality, what is death, is fundamental to mass control. And it has many knock-on effects, because people who are in fear give their power away to anyone they think is going to protect them from what they have been manipulated to fear. So, for instance, once you are in fear of death, you give your power away to anyone who you think can help you survive a little longer. And fundamental to this, of course, is giving your power away to doctors and the pharmaceutical industry, which is about wealth, not health.
Exactly.
So there are many, many benefits. In fact, it's absolutely the foundation of mass control, is to get people in ignorance of who they are and the nature of life and the nature of reality. And, of course, when you don't know what happens at death, do I just cease to exist? Am I going to be judged by some god? Which god is it? Is it going to be the Muslim god or the Jewish god, or is it going to be the Christian god? Which god is it going to be? And all this stuff. It puts you in a state of projected fear. You know, most people are in fear, not because of what's happening in the moment that they're feeling the fear, but they're projecting that fear into the future, and they fear what might come. This is the same with whether I'm going to meet the check for my mortgage at the end of the month, whether I'm going to be able to feed the kids and all the rest of it. But the biggest expression of that is fear of death. What happens? Am I going to be judged? Am I a bad person? Oh, my goodness, what will happen? Will I go to heaven? Will I go to hell? Oh, and it completely scrambles people's daily in the now experience. And of course, the older people get, the more this starts to influence and impact on their lives. So I don't fear death, because I know that it doesn't exist. This reality that we see through our eyes, or think we do, is a television station. It's a holographic television station. That's why it appears to be three-dimensional, as opposed to the flat-screen television that we see on the screen. And we enter this reality as consciousness, infinite, formless consciousness, energy, to experience this reality for whatever reason we chose to come. But we need an outer shell to interact with this frequency range, because consciousness is vibrating so quickly that without the outer shell that's vibrating within the frequency range of this this reality, this world, I couldn't hold this phone, I couldn't pick up a knife and fork, I couldn't interact with it. So we take on this outer shell, this fantastically sophisticated thinking computer we call the physical body. So when we come into this world, we come through the body into this reality. And then when we leave this world at what we call death, our consciousness withdraws from the genetic spacesuit, as I call it, the body computer, and continues its infinite existence in another reality, in another frequency or dimension of life. And so this is what's happening when people have near-death experiences, when they are experiencing being apart from the body. It's that withdrawal that they're experiencing of consciousness, what is the real infinite them, and the body, which has been the vehicle to experience this reality. So once you, I think this is the biggest area of control and manipulation of all, really. If you can be persuaded to identify who you are with your body rather than being infinite consciousness, then you are already observing yourself in reality from a fundamentally limited perspective. Once you identify with the body, the I can'ts start to reel off in an endless list. So identification with of self with the body is what we are manipulated to do. And once we do that, not only do we think in terms of limitation, not only do we misunderstand when body reactions happen, especially emotional ones, are not actually us from a infinite consciousness point of view. They are a reaction of the body to a particular experience. For instance, the fight or flight experience, when we feel fear and we either hit the guy or run, that comes from the reptilian part of the brain. That is a body reaction to an event. It's part of the body's survival mechanism, and it's a good thing, because the whole foundation of the body is survival, the survival instinct, the survival reaction. Of course it is, because we wouldn't last long if the body didn't have that survival mechanism. But when it gets out of hand to the point where we're starting to identify with that, then we enter the realm of living reality from a perspective of I must survive, I must survive. Oh, will I survive? Oh my God! And again, the bottom line part of this is, will I survive? Will I survive? Therefore, I fear death. And so, when you identify with the body, you're identifying with the death of the body as being your death. This is the major point. At which people get caught in this trap of fearing death and misunderstanding death. Yes, the body, quote, dies, just as, you know, a computer on my desk, one day that computer's going to stop working. And what do we say when the computer stops working? Hey, my computer's dead. Yeah, it's the same basic principle. So yes, the body dies, but the body's not us. And it's disconnecting the self of identity with the body that starts to free you from, I identifying with its demise, because it's not your demise, it's the demise of your vehicle.
Well, you've made a really wonderful point that, for example, when the computer breaks down, there's still the operator, there's still the computer operator, and that is such a beautiful illustration of this truth. And another interesting thing is the fact that I heard somebody several weeks ago so wisely say or point out that the number one enemy of the powers that be is consciousness. And I thought, yes, exactly, because what you were just pointing out is the fact that when we realize that death is not the death of our selfhood, that consciousness does continue to exist, then it's amazing power that we suddenly got access to. And whilst I was on the other side, and indeed it's been a few times, I experienced that very thing, seeing and being reminded that the physical plane is just a hologram. And I saw it as that. It was very, very interesting because it didn't look solid to me at all. And then when I was told that I had to come back into the physical plane, I was reminded that I wasn't to identify with this plane. This isn't who I am. I'm not to hook in. I'm just passing through. And I am to share the message that life is indeed eternal, that we do not cease to be when we leave our bodies behind. And another interesting point about this is that there are millions of us who've been to the other side now and have come back to talk about it, to share our experiences. And we don't even know that we're, quote, quote, dead. You know, some people hover over their bodies and they say, oh, there's a body there. Oh, goodness me, that looks like my body. But then if that's my body, where am I? Here I am, you know, outside of the body. So it's a very, very powerful realization that people, they continue to be conscious and they don't experience death. It's an afterthought, if the thought even exists at all. So this is a very powerful point you're making here, and I think it's intensely important that people can realize that they are infinite consciousness, and how can we get them to rise above the fear of this, because that is a very low vibrational frequency that we're dealing with. So that I'm so grateful that you're pointing this out. Now, I know another point I want to say too is that not everyone has got to go through what I call a death experience or a body death experience, because like you, David, you can have these powerful transformative experiences that put you into the light and make it very clear to you that you are infinite consciousness. Do you want to share a little bit about that also? Because I know that our listeners would be very interested in some of the experiences that you've had that have so made this so clear to you.
Well, you know, what has happened to me over the years and the way that I've come to these conclusions, I can only say that it's just a knowing. It's not something that needs articulating. It's not something that needs justifying or explaining, really, to myself. I just know that I am consciousness, and I've known this for quite a time now. And it's simply a case of moving beyond the intellect, which is the level of consciousness, a very low level of consciousness, which dominates this world and dominates this reality. And because the intellect is very, very much an expression of what I call body consciousness, of the body computer, we enter this physical vehicle, and we can stay in a state of infinite consciousness. And we can express that level of wisdom and understanding through the physical vehicle, like, I've said before, as you pointed out earlier, the symbolism of the computer operator being consciousness and the computer being the body. And we can do that. Or we can get caught in the trap that's been set for us in this reality of identifying with the body as being us, in which case we disconnect, at least in awareness. We never disconnect from infinite consciousness. How can you disconnect from what you are? But we disconnect from an awareness of that. That's the point. And we get trapped in the intellect. Now, the intellect is that level of consciousness when we are in embodiment, which allows us to interact with a world of apparent apartness, of apparent division, and to be able to identify with that and to cope with that. And it's a way of, through language and through being at a level of consciousness where you're directly interacting with this reality, where you can communicate here. And if you hold multidimensional self, then you can bring that higher level of understanding down into this reality and step it down into words and concepts that can be understood here. And so the intellect in that way is a very, very good thing. It's like an interpreter. I would put it that way. It is an interpreter taking the language of higher consciousness, which is knowing, and interpreting it into our form of language and communicating it. However, if we get caught in the trap of identifying with body consciousness as who we are, we get trapped in the intellect. This manifests itself overwhelmingly through the left brain, which is, can I see it, touch it, hear it, taste it? Okay, it exists then. Otherwise, it can't exist. Prove it to me. Prove it to me. Show me. Do an experiment. That's how it works. And if we get trapped in the intellect in isolation, then we can get in serious trouble in terms of understanding the nature of who we are, reality, everything. Because the intellect is interested in the twigs. It's not really cannot open itself to see the forest and the connections. It wants to know about the twigs in detail and complexity. And what's this? Ooh, ooh, get the microscope. Ooh, what's this? And most people in this world are trapped in the intellect. And I'm not just talking about the so-called intellectuals. I'm talking about people in general, even those who have not been to university or have not been very good at school. They might not have a developed intellect, but they're still filtering reality and observing reality through the intellect. And so they're seeing themselves and the world in terms of division, apartness. I'm one person, you're another person, there's nothing between us, we are apart, we are, quote, individuals, there are no connections. And once we do that, then, of course, we are moving further and further away from the awareness of who we really are, which is infinite consciousness, the same infinite consciousness that we all are. We are the ocean, but the intellect sees the ocean only in terms of droplets. And that's why it gets confused. And as I was saying in a program on this station the other day, it's an irony that when I go and speak at universities, particularly the elite ones like Oxford, as I did about 3 weeks ago, I have to explain these things that we're talking about today and that I talk about in my public talks openly and holding nothing back. I have to do it in baby steps to these intellectual elite people, as they see themselves, because the intellect has got them so massively trapped in seeing the world of division and physicality when it's actually illusory, that they can't get these bigger concepts. They can't literally open their mind to encompass them. And if you look at society, to progress within it and to enter the positions of control and influence in the institutions that run society, like government, like banking, like medicine, like science, you have to be of an intellectual level that you can absorb vast amounts of this world left brain intellectual information and then regurgitate it back on an exam paper when you're asked to. And if you do that really well, then you get big exam passes at school. And if you do it really well, then you go to an elite university like Oxford or Cambridge or Yale or Harvard. And then you go through the same process again at a higher level. And then you leave to become a doctor or a lawyer or a scientist, but then you take your exams in your specialization and you go through the same process again. And so by the time you reach the positions of influence in society, like science and government administration and all the rest, doctors, you are already a left brain prisoner enslaved by the intellect and filtering reality through the intellect's version of perception. And therefore, this whole society all over the world is actually run every day by intellectual enslaved people, by the very structure through which they enter those positions of power and influence. And this is why when, you know, here we are, Juliet, here we are. Here we are after thousands of years of so-called human evolution, and we're still saying, who are we? What is death? It's a mystery, and all this stuff, because the intellect-dominated society and institutions cannot, and if you go high enough in the conspiracy, do not want to understand and communicate to the people that understanding of the nature of life itself. It's not that we don't understand life itself. It's that the structure of society is there to stop that understanding becoming mainstream and widely available to people.
This is so true, and I'm really sad to say that unfortunately our organization, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, is also dominated by academics and academia, and most of the board members, bless them, they're academics, they're not experiencers.
And because they are academics, they will be interested, I don't know this, but this is the way it goes, they will be interested in structure, they'll be interested in hierarchy, they'll be interested in rules and regulations of the organization. They'll introduce the cans and cannots. Suddenly there are people who are acceptable and there are people who are not acceptable who won't toe the party line. This is the way the intellect works, and every organization that is intellect dominated and created operates in the same way, because the intellect is basically stupid. Intellectualism is incredibly stupid compared with higher consciousness, but it, along with its ignorance, it also has this arrogance that it knows it all, therefore
yes.
Ignorance and arrogance invariably go together, and they go together because of the intellect. I've got close friends in alternative healing and what have you, and these alternative forms of healing are coming from the perspective of seeing the connections, of seeing the whole, of seeing how one part is connected and influenced by another part because they're all one. And that is not intellect. You need the intellect to articulate the methods and means of how alternative forms of healing work, yes. But you need the right brain, creative side of our physical personality to understand the big picture within which alternative healing operates and therefore works. So what's happening now is exactly the same as you describe. Alternative healing is being taken over by the academics, and what they do is that they create a hierarchy, they create a structure, they put someone or others in positions of power within that structure simply because they've passed lots of exams and got letters after their name, therefore they must be extremely clever. And that's an interesting point, actually. Cleverness and wisdom are not the same thing.
Exactly.
The intellect can be very clever on a basic level of of how something works and all the rest of it. But it, being clever doesn't mean being wise. You know, it's very clever to build an atomic bomb. It's not wise to do so. And the fact that they build atomic bombs means that the intellect is in charge and not higher consciousness. And so what they then do is they start this licensing system whereby suddenly alternative healers have to be licensed. And to be licensed, and of course there's a fee to be licensed, you have to satisfy and operate within the bounds of what the hierarchy has decided you must work within the bounds of. You know, I'm sure that the way we're going, out-of-body experiences are going to be subject to licensing, you know, Julia. You cannot have an out-of-body experience, you're not licensed. I mean, and this is the way the internet works. It's incredibly stupid, but extraordinarily destructive in terms of freedom and the free flow of thought and the free flow of consciousness in this world.
Well, that's so true. And in fact, a few years ago, I had even offered to give a talk at one of the conferences, and I was rejected. They said, oh, well, you can be on a panel of near-death experiences and people can ask questions, but they weren't interested in having me give a talk, even though I have given a few talks. And I realized it was because I didn't have letters after my name. Well, I do have letters after my name now. It's exp.d, Doctor of Experience. Because to me, that is the greatest education there is, the wisdom that comes through experience. And, you know, I just think it's such a sad state of affairs when someone, and I'm talking about a myriad of people who are so brilliant, so intelligent, so wise, who've had compounded experiences, yet they're totally shunned because they don't have these academic, let me be specific here, academic degrees after their names. That doesn't mean that they are not deeply knowing and fully aware of, you know, the topic that they want to share. And I think it is something that's been very, very hard for me to contend with because I do feel very shunned as a result of the fact that I haven't been to university. Well, I had a wonderful gift of being too deathly ill to make it to university, so I dropped out.
I went to university, thank you, God, because I wanted to be a professional footballer when I was at school, and that was my motivation, that was my ambition, and nothing else was going to get in the way. And I went to school, and I took very little in, both at infant school, junior school, and then at the high school. And I just passed the day looking out the window, daydreaming away. I always tried to find myself a seat in the classroom by the window. And I used to play for the school football team and meet my mates, and that's why I went to school. I've done all my learning in my time on my terms, and I've learned what I decided to learn rather than this absolute tidal wave of much of it irrelevant nonsense that is bombarding and polluting the minds of young people from the age of 4 or 5 right up to when they leave to go into the adult world. It is mind pollution, a lot of this education. I'm not saying that, you know, it's not useful in terms of some things that are learned, but much of it is what I call mind pollution. It's just filling the mind with irrelevant stuff that doesn't need to be there. So I was fortunate although I was more fortunate than you in the reason why, I never went through the education system in any way focused on it. It just passed me by. And I was so delighted with that. But the thing is, you see, that it's not just that we are dominated by the intellect in this reality. The intellect is a figure of worship in this reality. This is the point. People think less of themselves if they don't have the intellectual capacity that others have. Oh, he's ever so clever. You can ask him anything. You can ask him what size Eskimo takes and all that stuff. And he always knows. Yeah, but so what? You know, if I want to know that kind of information, then I'll get a book or I'll go on the internet and I'll find it. I don't need to have it on tap in my head. There's more that I want to use my mind for than remembering intellectual facts so that I can posture how clever I am. Oh, yeah, well, ask me a question, I'll know the answer. Oh, yes, oh, you're so clever. Oh, yes, I know, I'm very clever, aren't I? And it's the worship of the intellect. And because of this worship, we put on pedestals people who've been through the exam passing process, like scientists. Oh, he's a scientist, he must know what he's talking about. Excuse me, scientists a few centuries ago said the Earth was flat, mate. You know,
yes, exactly.
It was scientists that came up with thalidomide and said it was safe, mate. It was a scientist that came up with these drugs that suddenly have to be taken off the market because they're killing people. You know, having an intellect doesn't mean you are special kind of intelligent person. It just means you're good at passing exams. Now, you might be intelligent, but you don't have to be. And a lot of these people that are held up as figures of, oh, my God, he's so clever, are actually basically stupid. We've got a guy in this country, Juliet, called Professor Richard Dawkins. And he is a professor at Oxford University. And he is obsessed, utterly obsessed, with ridiculing religion and ridiculing alternative methods of healing, alternative views of physics, alternative views of reality. And he's saying that, oh, religions and all that stuff. What he doesn't realize is he is an evangelist. He's an evangelist for the religion of scientism, which is the worship of science, mainstream science, the worship of this world is all there is, there's no life after death, the whole package you get from these people. And he is a classic example of an intellectual enslaved person who thinks he knows it all, but he simply is in a state of not being able to open his mind to understand outside of this tiny box his intellect, which may be advanced in terms of he knows what this name for this is, my Latin name for that, and all that stuff. But he's in a tiny box the size of a pea in terms of the breadth of vision he has of life, reality, and possibility. So we need to stop worshipping the intellect and start opening our minds to consciousness, which is beyond the intellect. And consciousness, in its true sense, doesn't have a box. The intellect must have a box or it doesn't feel comfortable.
Well, there's another person, speaking of which, also in the UK, who's just like this lad that you're talking about. In fact, I read a lot of her book, and then I just finally had to put it down and say, oh, enough of this nonsense. Susan Blackmore.
I don't think she's still there, but she was at the, used to be for a long time at the University of West of England at Bristol.
Yes.
Yeah, every single program, I mean, I'm not seeing her for a while now, but every single program, which was rare, but there was a time when there were a few more than there is now, that was about strange phenomena and people's strange experiences, whether it's out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, experiences of remembering previous lives or whatever, she would be wheeled on at the end to debunk these people's experiences. And I remember once she talked about the fact that out-of-body and near-death experiences, particularly near-death experiences, were the brain remembering its life, basically. All these things that have happened in its life, that was the memory regurgitating. Well, unless you've had a memory in your life and therefore an experience of floating above your body looking down on it, how can that possibly be? It's a nonsense. But again, we have an intellectually enslaved person who cannot get beyond the can I see it, touch it, taste it? Well, it doesn't exist then, or it exists then, or whatever. And also when I'm observing Susan Blackmore, and for Susan Blackmore, read endless, countless academics all over the world. I see someone who has, shall we say, as they say in all the right places, issues. She has issues with regard to life after death. I think she had some kind of experience before, earlier in her life, and somehow it's like her debunking or attempted debunking of it is basically like her saying, don't want to talk about it, change the subject. And you have in America, as we have here, this thing called the Skeptic Society, which is Susan Blackmore and then some. And the skeptics think that they are questioning people, but they're not. Is it good to be a skeptic? Absolutely not. Is it good to question? Of course. But questioning and skepticism is not the same thing. When you're questioning something, be it paranormal phenomena or a near-death experience or whatever, you question it from an impartial point of view where you are letting the information be your guide to its credibility. What a skeptic does is defend his or her preconceived idea and belief system that there is no life after death. Therefore, I am going to set out here to debunk and undermine and dismiss any idea that these people are suggesting that out-of-body near-death experiences can exist. And so skepticism is not questioning. It's the desperate defense of their preconceived belief system till their knuckles turn white holding on to it, to debunk anybody who says anything that is outside of their pea-sized belief system. I was on a television program last year. It was a program looking at conspiracy theories. And, of course, the word conspiracy does not exist in isolation in the mainstream media and in the mainstream mind. It can't, because there can be no conspiracies, even though, you know, they're coming to light all the time. There has to be a conspiracy theory. So theory always goes with conspiracy in the mainstream of public experience. You're a conspiracy theorist. Yeah, I've written 2 million words in my last 5 or 6 books. Yeah, and all the sources are at the end of each chapter. All the connections are there to see. Yeah, it's a conspiracy theory. That's right. Yeah, go on. Anyway, and this program brought this man to meet me called Chris French, who is the head of psychology at the Goldsmith Institute, I think it's called, at London University. So he comes along, and what I find is those who debunk and dismiss near-death experiences and this sort of phenomena also dismiss in this world conspiracy information like the background to 9/11 and all the rest of it. That the two go together because the intellect is defending a belief system, and that belief system is so intellectually based that anything outside of it must be wrong. So conspiracy theories and near-death experiences are one and the same to that state of mind. They can't, neither can be possible. And he started off talking to me on the camera. And the first thing he said is, we've had a very interesting, and he thought, highly significant survey. He says, we talked to thousands of people. I go, yeah. He said, we have found that people who are more trusting of government are less likely to believe in conspiracy theories. And those people who are less trusting of government are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. So, I mean, you know, my jaw dropped. I said, how much did that cost you? You know, give me a ring, I could have told you that. Of course that's going to be the case. And I said to him, he was going on, oh, there's no evidence in your books for what you say. I said, have you read my books? There came the classic answer, no. I said, well, how do you know if you haven't read them? I've read articles about you in the newspapers. Right, this is the level that the intellect operates upon. But the thing was that I didn't know much about this Chris French guy, and he's going on about 9/11 and making ridiculous comments. And what I noticed, both about him and his intellectual state, which manifests itself through academia overwhelmingly, is that they're looking for a getaway car to keep their belief system intact. So they will keep saying that, oh, well, it might be this, it might be that, it might be, you could explain it like this. And the explanations get more and more ludicrous and more bizarre. But it doesn't matter. They're never going to check them out. They're never going to see if their ludicrous explanations for these phenomena and these conspiracies are actually check out and stand up to scrutiny. They're not going to do that. As long as they have the possibility that, well, it could be this, you could explain it this way, that's good enough for them, because the getaway car is revving up and they jump in and they're away. Their belief system's safe because it could be explained like this. And it was interesting because I didn't know much about this guy. He just turned up for the filming, and I heard he was from London University and all the rest of it. But as I said earlier, what I found is those that dismiss the conspiracy research without checking it, without reading it clearly, are the same people that dismiss paranormal phenomena like near-death experiences. So I go home, and I go on the internet, because I thought, I want to know more about this guy. And I go to his website, and there, my latest area of research, he says, is investigating so-called paranormal phenomena for which there are rational explanations, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, classic. That's just the way academia works, because it's dominated by the intellect, and that's how the intellect works. And if we do not move beyond the intellect, beyond the lower mind, then we are going to keep on just regurgitating this world as we see it today, because intellect has created it. And unless we move beyond intellect, intellect will go on creating and recreating it in the same form. You know, they talk about in the Bible, God apparently saying, actually it's the gods, if you go back to the original translation, but in the St. James version of the Bible, God says about, we will create man in my image, or I will create man in my image, is the way it's perceived by Christians. And in terms of the intellect and this reality that we live in, it is just like that. This reality has been created in the image of the intellect. And as Einstein said, you cannot solve problems with the same level of consciousness that created them. And that's what we're doing all the time.
Yes.
We have a political party that creates problems, then another political party says, we'll solve the problems, vote for us. So they get in, and they create more problems. Why? Because they're doing it with the same level of consciousness that created them. And so this movement beyond the intellect to consciousness in its higher form is the only way that we are going to transform this reality from the prison it's become and even more becoming to the paradise it can be. The paradise is created by that level of consciousness, that level of wisdom, that level of love, of understanding, of empathy, that is beyond intellect. And that's where we need to go if we're going to change this world. Because if we think we're going to do it intellectually, then we are kidding ourselves.
Well, there was an acquaintance who's a very devout Baptist Christian minister, as a matter of fact. And he's a nice, nice man, but he made a very telling statement, and I quote, "We conservatives want to get it right the first time because we are not willing to change our minds." And I thought, ooh, how true is that? And then I was thinking about Susan again, how she would just keep going on and on about NDEs being the result of a dying brain, but yet Dr. Peter Finnick and Dr. Pim Van Lommel have both pointed out that during a near-death state, there is no brainwave activity whatsoever, and consciousness, what we experience in the during a near-death episode is way beyond what the brain can even filter. And of course, we've all simultaneously come to the same conclusions that the brain is nothing but a receptor or receiver. It's not the broadcaster.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a filter. And because it's a filter, it filters us into a sense of limitation and a sense of apartness. And that's okay. I mean, I'm sure our consciousness decided to experience this sense of limitation and sense of apartness for a reason of experience or whatever. But once we leave the body, we withdraw from the filter. What's in my mind as I'm speaking is a telescope where you look through one end and everything's bigger, and you look through the other end and everything's smaller. Well, when we come into this reality, it's like looking through a telescope from the big end, so everything looks smaller. And then when we leave, we switch the telescope around, we see everything from a much bigger perspective. And people are so connected, especially intellects and intellectuals. They're so connected, and they so perceive reality through physicality that they cannot comprehend, for instance, that when consciousness leaves the body, it is able to see, because of course you can only see with your eyes. How can consciousness hear when it's got no ears? And how can it taste when it's got no tongue and all the rest of it? But they don't understand the mechanism through which the body is perceiving reality. What's happening is the senses are sensors that are picking up environmental vibrational influences, which we call taste and sound and sight. And they are passing this information to the brain, which decodes it into what we taste, what we hear, and what we see. We see with the brain, we don't see with our eyes. And what is happening in that process? It is a process of vibrational transformation. The vibrational transformation to electrical signals, to the brain decoding the electrical signals into reality, just like a television decodes frequency fields into television pictures. Now, the body is doing this within this reality, within this tiny frequency range called visible light that our eyes can access and therefore see. It's just one television station within infinite television stations, all existing in the same space on different frequencies, different wavelengths. So what the body is doing is taking these vibrational influences, these vibrational fields, and they are transforming. It is transforming them into pictures. And what is the body? It itself is a vibrational field, which is just a hologram. It's not actually physical. So when we leave the body, that process of the consciousness decoding vibrational fields into pictures, into sound, into whatever, continues when we leave the body. But it's doing it on a much higher level, free of the limitations of the filter, transformer, receiver, transmitter we call the body, which is doing the same thing, but it's doing it in a much more limited form, because this is the realm of limitation, I guess. It's just a form of experience. So when we leave the body, a death or near-death experience, our consciousness continues the same process that was happening in the body, except that it's doing it in a infinitely wider less limited way, far less limited way. And so instead of decoding just one level of reality, which basically the five senses do, it's decoding multiple levels of reality. And this is why when you read the accounts of near-death experiences, they talk again and again about the fact that they were able to comprehend many, many different levels of reality simultaneously. Yes, of course, they talk about they knew everything that had happened, that was happening, that was going to happen. It was all happening in the same moment. Yes, there was no sequence. There was no time. Yes, that's what it is. The illusion of time comes from the filter of body consciousness and this limited reality. This sense of apartness and sequence leads to perception of time, a perception of passing through something when it's all happening in the same now. And so because academia does not understand what the body is actually doing in terms of translating five sense environmental influences into the reality that we perceive, it doesn't realize that all that the body is doing in a more limited way is what consciousness does when it leaves the body. And that's why when consciousness is sort of looking down on its own body in an operating theater or whatever, it is decoding the energy field, which is the body's prime form, into a holographic reality, the physical body as we perceive it in this holographic way, in the same way that the body was doing it before, except that it's doing it more efficiently and it's doing it in a more infinite, limitless way. It's the same process. It's just a different level of it.
I wrote a wonderful article on my blog entitled The Cosmic Website, because I do design and build websites, and of course I use a lot of HTML code. And when I'm doing that, it was reminding me so much of my experience on the other side, because, you know, we see these beautiful websites, and they've got their functionality and their imagery and their colors and audio and all of that. But what is behind the website, when you look at the source of it, it's nothing but a bunch of gibberish, basically text, written on a white background, and it's formulated in such a way that the browser or computer decodes it and makes it into the beautiful websites that you experience, and it was reminding me of this. So I thought, all right, this is a really good metaphor here, because this physical plane that we are experiencing is basically a bunch of HTML.
And that's absolutely spot on. I mean, I've used that analogy myself in my books. And if you remember the Matrix movie,
I never saw it. I wish there was a book, because I'd love to read the book. I can't take any kind of violence or graphic, it's just right back.
Yeah, the violence in it was horrible and unnecessary. I'm talking about the basic way that they symbolized reality was extremely accurate. And there came a point where the Neo character, towards the end of the first film, he had been through this process of transformation, where he'd gone from thinking that he was who he saw in the mirror, to realizing that it was all an illusion and that he had infinite possibility to manipulate the illusion. And again, it's interesting, we're coming back to the same thing. We started off talking about death. What happened right at the end is that he's being chased by these agents who are nothing more than holograms coming in and out of this reality. And he eventually got shot dead in this dingy hotel. And he went on the floor and he died, apparently. But he had reached the point where he was becoming so free of the illusion that he eventually stood up again, even though he'd been shot many times and should have been dead. And when he did this, suddenly his whole reality changed, because he had gone to that point where he'd overcome the illusion of death. And he was looking at these three agents, and they looked like three guys, human beings, pointing guns at him. But then he moved beyond that as this transformation took him over as he overcame death, or the illusion of death. And suddenly those agents were no longer humans as we perceive them. They were just digital entities. They were just numbers and codes. And, you know, in the Matrix movies, when they're outside of the Matrix and they're looking at the computer, the computer screens that are connected to the Matrix, going up and down the computer screens are just green numbers and letters in the very way that you've just described, Juliet. But what they were seeing when they looked at the screens was streets and people and cars and all the rest of it. And this is what is happening. The brain is decoding frequency fields, and on one level, yes, digital constructs into holographic reality. You know how you can put software into a computer and it comes up on the screen, the best of it anyway, in three-dimensional form.
Right.
On a flat screen, it comes up in three-dimensional form. And that's what the brain is doing. If you think what a computer can do now on your desk, imagine what something as phenomenally sophisticated and advanced as the human brain could do compared with a computer. And the computers do amazing things increasingly today. It's the same basic process. And when we leave the body, the process continues of decoding frequency fields, etc., into pictures which we perceive as reality. But we just do it in a far less limited way. So there is no real basic difference when we leave the body in how we decode reality, except that we do it in a much more expansive way. And that's why people can look down on their physical bodies and see without eyes and hear without ears, because they're just going on decoding reality.
Well, the good point of that too, David, is the fact that my body is visually impaired, and so it's never been able to see well. However, during my near-death states and even my spiritually transformative states, I had 360-degree vision. So obviously that can't be a product of a dying brain and what have you, because my brain, of this body doesn't know how to see, quote-unquote, in the conventional sense of the word. There are a number of blind people who seen perfectly during their near-death states, deaf people who heard perfectly during their near-death states. So this, you know, this should be real huge evidence here about the fact that our consciousness has got really nothing to do with the brain. It's just something that's transmitted through the brain and decoded, as we've been talking about. And I had a wonderful guest on this show last week. I'm really quite in awe of the synchronicity of how these events have happened. When you were ill and couldn't come on the show on the second, and Neil offered to come on, Neil Haig, bless him. And then last week, we did some musical chairs, and I had Andy Petrow on. And it was uncanny how similar our near-death experiences were. And he was talking about the fact that being on the other side, that he was using the very words that I have used, that, for example, experiencing the life review, he experienced everything in the eternal now. It wasn't sequential, and of course it's hard for people who are locked in physical so-called reality to grasp this.
Yeah.
But I just kept nodding, yes, yes, because that is my experience exactly. And another important point that he made was that he was so at one with all that is, And yet, he didn't lose his sense of andiness. And he said, this sounds like a contradiction, and I was nodding because I had that same experience. You don't lose your sense of self, but it's not the ego. It's just that you are merged with that light, but there's still that unique expression of that light source.
Yeah, what it is, I would suggest, is a unique point of observation.
Yes.
It's like you can be a droplet of water in the South China Sea, and symbolically you have a point of observation of the ocean. Or you can be a droplet in the ocean just off the south coast of England or just off the west coast of America, and you will have a different point of observation, but you're still the same ocean.
Yes.
And so we are different points of observation. And indeed, freedom and changing the way that we see ourselves in the world is simply moving your point of observation. If your point of observation is through the intellect, you'll see it in a certain way. If your point of observation is higher consciousness, then you'll see it in a completely different way. And because this world is dominated by the intellectual point of observation, this is why those that are observing from point of higher consciousness stand out like a sore thumb. They're called strange or extreme or nutty, dangerous even. But it's like the Japanese have a saying, don't be the nail that stands out above the rest because that's the first one to get hit. And invariably, the people that stand out above the rest are those who are coming from a point of observation of higher consciousness because the vast majority of the nails are actually observing the world through the intellect. And it's interesting also that you mentioned about the 360 degrees of vision. Well, that's bound to be the case because consciousness does not have its vision directed through the physical body, which directs the vision through the eyes. Consciousness is decoding reality all the time in every single angle, which way you can think of. It does not have a form in that sense. It does not have limitation in that sense. So because of that, once you're out of the body, which directs sight decoding through from the eyes to the brain, you're bound to be able to see 360 degrees, because 360 degrees of you is decoding reality. And when people lose physical senses, what is happening is that the computer is damaged so that you can't use that particular decoding mechanism of the computer, then it makes you more sensitive often to decode through a higher level of consciousness that is beyond the body. And when you do that, you can decode reality through senses that apparently you don't have because they're not working in the computer. No, but they're working on the level of consciousness, and you can still decode a form of that sense, even with the that sense decoder of the body not working. It's the same with you sitting at a computer. You know, if your Word file is not working, the rest of the computer is working, but if your Word file is not working, then it's very you cannot operate through that file. And this is what happens in the body. You know, when people are mentally handicapped or mentally damaged by a road accident or something, what people call always just a vegetable. Well, he's not a vegetable. He is infinite consciousness, but he can't express that infinite consciousness through the computer because basically it's knackered. You know, if you drop a computer on the floor, it ain't going to work. You plug it in the wall. If you dropped it on the floor, it's probably not going to work. It's the same when, you know, we get hit by a car or whatever. But that's not who we are. The vehicle is damaged. The vehicle has the mental handicap, not the consciousness that is inhabiting that vehicle. And when the consciousness leaves the body, no matter how mentally handicapped they may appear to be in physicality, they are infinite consciousness, in the same awareness of other people that leave the body who have perfect computers. You know, it's again understanding who we are against the vehicle we're experiencing through.
There was a, I wrote another article on my blog about, I'm trying to find the title of it here, where someone was asking about her mum, who had Alzheimer's, and she was wondering, she held up a picture of her mum's wedding day, and the lady said, "Who's that man?" And her daughter was so brokenhearted that her mum did not recognize her own husband. And so she was wondering if she had a near-death experience as she crossed over, if she would be able to recognize her husband, you know, who was already on the other side. And I wrote in my response to that, I said that this is, you know, this is not... Oh, let's see, it's called a question of recognition, that is. The person, you know, it's only the brain that is damaged, but as soon as she transitioned outside of the confines of the brain, she will be her full consciousness again and will indeed recognize her husband and everybody else and be fully intact.
Exactly.
I think this is a very important point to make because I think about all of the millions of us, David, there's literally millions of us who have had death experiences and been sent back and similar transformative experiences. You know, there's a really important reason why we've been sent back, to share the fact that life is indeed eternal, that we do not cease to be when we leave our body computers. And I can't think of a more appropriate analogy than that one, because the computer still needs the operator. And I wonder what, you know, people like Susan Blackmore et al., what is the payoff in being so hell-bent on denying the fact that we are infinite consciousness? Why do people so want to disprove that we are eternal consciousness? The people
well,
don't
I
want
think,
to be stuck in this.
I think there are a number of reasons. One is that they have belief systems to protect. And it's very difficult for people who have been through a life and an academic career that's based on one belief system to then say, excuse me, forget everything I've been saying so far because that ain't right. And so people defend their status quo because they don't want to admit their status quo all along has been flawed. They also, and I think, as I said earlier, Susan Blackmore is an example of this from what I've observed. She has issues of her own with regard to life after death and near-death experiences and paranormal phenomena. And I do sense someone who is saying, change the subject, don't want to talk about it. But, of course, the other level of this, the basic check at the end of the month level of this, is that these structures of society, academia, science, whatever, they are controlled by limitation on what you can say and believe if you are going to be in those positions of influence and power up to a point. If you are a doctor, for instance, and you start talking about alternative methods of healing being more effective than the scalpel and the drug, then you'll get jumped on from a very great height, as many doctors have who've come to that conclusion. I took my son years ago to a hospital casualty unit where he'd got injured playing football, and we just wanted to check if he'd broken anything or not. And he was, you know, quite a small boy, and he was a bit upset by it. And the doctor came in, young doctor, and he said, "I'll give him some rescue remedy." I'm thinking,
"Oh, bless
rescue remedy." I said, what do the authorities think about you giving people retching remedy? He said, I don't tell them. He said, I just do it on the quiet. He says, you know, he says, you see those nurses out there? He said, I treat all them homeopathically. But he's doing it on the quiet because although it works and it's effective, he will be jumped on by authority. And it's the same with academia. You know, if that Chris French guy who came along with his closed mind, his concrete mind, trying to debunk conspiracies being true and paranormal phenomena being real. If he'd have taken the stance of, yeah, I think there could be something in these conspiracies. I mean, we ought to investigate them more, you know, because we ought to look at them. And yes, paranormal activity, there's a lot more to know, you know, about the nature of the mind and everything. He wouldn't be head of psychology at the Goldsmiths Institute of London University. He just wouldn't be. And so there is this psychological fascism, as I call it,
which
insists that if you're going to be in these positions of influence within academia, etc., and science, then you have to toe the party line. That's why I talk in my books about song sheet scientists, because that's what most of them are.
Mm. And I want to ask, too, you know, I should think that having that mindset that they're absolutely locked in fear, and, you know, I wonder, well, are they enjoying being afraid? Are they enjoying living a life of fear or thinking that they're just going to be obliterated when their bodies pop out, you know? It just is so strange to me.
I think there's a lot of fear in it. I mean, I mentioned the guy earlier, Professor Richard Dawkins. When I see him doing his documentaries mocking alternative healing or whatever, and I see him attacking religion. I mean, you know, I'm not into religion, but, you know, everyone has the right to believe what they want to believe. You know, the right to be wrong is a right that we all need to have, because if you don't have the right to be wrong, the right to be misunderstanding something, then there is no freedom. Because if you don't have the right to be wrong or the right to be to misunderstand something, then that means that someone's deciding what is right and wrong and what you are understanding or misunderstanding, and that means that we're in a state where some or a world where someone or some force is deciding what you must believe to be right or wrong. And the more, I look at this thing, there is no real right or wrong. It's just different points of observation. That's what there are, different points of observation. There's a point of observation that is looking at a brick from about an inch, and there's a point of observation on the top of the hill that's looking out across the housing estate. And the two points of observation are neither is wrong in a sense, because the person who's looking at a brick from an inch away is saying, you know, I'm in a reality which is really hard, and it's a kind of a ready color, and it's a bit rough, and it seems to be, you know, connected to these other chunks that are like that and all the rest of it. And yet someone at the top of the hill is looking out across the panorama, and he's saying, yeah, it's a big housing estate, look at it. Now, neither are wrong, but their points of observation are fundamentally different. And we get caught up in this I'm right, you're wrong and stuff. Again, that's the intellect at work. The intellect sees the world in terms of absolutes, in terms of absolutely right or absolutely wrong. And this is why it is so limited, because that's not the way it is, I would suggest. But this guy, Professor Richard Dawkins, when I see him at work, I do see a desperation. It's like controlled panic almost, in the way he is desperate to debunk these things and preserve his own belief system. And to a certain extent, you know, to a large extent really, people get their sense of security from a sense of everything in its place. You know, people who are in fear have a great difficulty dealing with states of flux, with states of not being able to know the outcome, but just flowing with where it's going. They don't feel comfortable with that. Again, we're dealing with an expression of fear of the unknown, I guess. And people like to have their belief systems nicely packaged, nice little ribbon, in the right place on the mantelpiece, and just the same distance from the next one, and just the same distance from the next one. Everything's just right and dandy, and it's all ever nice, and I've got it all on my shelf, and I feel comfortable now. This, you see this in people who want next Tuesday to be like this Tuesday, because then they feel safe and secure, knowing that nothing is changing. Things being the same can become an absolute sense of security. And in the same principle, and along the same theme, people are like that with belief systems. The way they perceive the world, they like it to be nice and fixed and unchanging, because that gives them a sense of security in from the point that they're observing the world. When you go to higher levels of consciousness, suddenly the unpredictable flow starts to become a joy. It starts to become something that is exciting and liberating, rather than something to fear. And it's, again, just a different point of observation. And it's, the way I perceive this sometimes with people who are frightened to let go, or frightened to just flow with life instead of trying to control life and everything. It's a bit like people who are frightened of the dentist. And they have an appointment at the dentist, and they're terrified for weeks and weeks on end of going to the dentist. And the closer it gets, the more frightened they get, the more anxious they get, the more uncomfortable they get. Then they go along to the dentist, and they go in the chair, and the guy does the little check and all this stuff, and you know, says, "Oh yeah, that's fine. Okay, another 6 months. Get the appointment on the way out." And the people walk out, and they go, "Well, that was great, wasn't it? Oh, that was no problem, wasn't it?" No, it wasn't. But you've spent weeks destroying your life and your enjoyment of the now in worry and anxiety about something that, at the end of it, it was just fine. And it's what you find when you let go and you flow with it, and you just let life take you where it takes you, rather than you trying to tell life where it should take you. You realize there is nothing to fear, but it is such a joy, it's such an excitement, such a liberating feeling, that you're not limited by do's and don'ts and can'ts. I would just say to people, you know, don't be frightened of being who you are, because that's what most people are frightened of being who they are. They feel more comfortable in their fake persona they see in the mirror when, if they just let go and express who they really are, then they'd realize that they've been living in a box of severe limitation, which, far from being secure and safe, is just a prison which they've been living in. And when you do let go, you kind of say, "I wish this had happened years and years and years ago," because it is such a different state of being, a wonderful place to be, challenging, but still a wonderful place to be.
Well, I know that when we've had our near-death experiences, and being on the other side, being enveloped in that unconditional love, which is totally unmistakable and ineffable, it's really quite impossible to describe, but there's such a tremendous peace that comes about, no sense of fear whatsoever. And I noticed that you have written and spoken about that, you know, with this peace, there is a stillness, because things are not vibrating the way that we experience them on the physical plane.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, again, there's this amazing knowing, and with that knowing, it really seems somewhat synonymous, really, because with the love comes the knowing, which brings about this total peace, and the fear completely evaporates. And there, and another thing that happened too was the realization that everything is evolving exactly the way it should, and that there was no need to worry about anything because it's really all taken care of by infinite love, infinite consciousness. And so this is what really, when I start to get nervous about things on this side, I just remind myself of that everything is taken care of, everything is working for the best good. And I focus on flowing, just like you were talking about, because when we can do this, then we can see the perfection in everything that happened. Just like, for example, when you became ill and couldn't be on my show on the second, and then Neil came on, and that was an absolutely wonderful show. And you and I have both been dealing with health challenges, and the prayers and the love that's been sent out has just been so powerful and so monumental. And I can't tell you the gratitude that I'm feeling right now. The love itself is literally what's carrying me right now. Nothing else. And then,
well, I think the absence of love always brings the absence of peace. And the absence of love always brings fear. Fear is the absence of love.
Exactly.
It's not something that exists in its own right, fear. It's the absence of something. It's the absence of love. And I think that also that while we may consciously forget where we've come from, forget who we are, there is a level of us that doesn't forget. And I think that a lot of psychological problems, a lot of unease that people have, a lot of sadness, sense of loss that they can't put words to because there doesn't seem to be a reason for it that people feel, is this subconscious memory of the nature of who they really are.
Yeah.
And the sadness comes from not being in connection with that while they are in this reality. It's like losing something. It's like losing a loved one or being apart from a loved one. It's a sense of loss, a sense of losing something, which is all subconscious in most people, but it's there. And I'm sure that a lot of feelings that people have, which they can't explain from their life experience, comes from this feeling of loss, of disconnection. I came out of the womb feeling sad, I got to tell you. And
me
I
too.
Felt sad all my life. And,
me too.
You know, I'm not, you know, I don't go around kind of moping and sad all the time externally. But, and, you know, I have a laugh and all the rest of it. But there is part of me where I always feel sadness. And even when I was a kid, I felt sad. Now, what's a kid feeling sad for? I mean, I never had a privileged upbringing in terms of money. We were skint and all the rest of it, and a council estate in Leicester in the English Midlands. But it wasn't a deprived childhood. Yes, it was financially, but it certainly wasn't a deprived childhood in terms of, you know, my parents and the life that I had, especially at a young age. There was no reason why I should feel the sadness, but I did, and I've always felt it. And the more that I've kind of understood it, the more it is this disconnection from the world, the realities beyond this realm of limitation, that is the cause of the sadness. And also the sadness, as I've understood more, of observing a world of conflict and suffering and emotional trauma, which is happening for no other reason than we forgot who we are.
Yes.
And that is also a part of the sadness. But I do think that this sense of disconnection, this sense of loss, even though consciously people might not be able to say why, I think that is a deep-seated reason for so much emotional feeling that people cannot explain from the experiences they've had in their lives.
I've been through exactly the same thing through all of my life because recall my first memories, I think about the fact that I remembered coming from a place where there was complete harmony, complete union, complete love, and I'm not talking about union in the context of being controlled like the one world or new world order that they're trying to impose, but the real oneness that comes from love, that comes from all these unique expressions all being in concert together, working and being creative and being in that love, always in harmony. And I've been sad to realize that the people don't have access to this love, or they don't feel it, or there's always this barrier around them. And like yourself, I've been grief-stricken all of my life, and at the same time feeling so compelled to help to eliminate this, to help bridge that gap, to bring us back in touch with who we really are. And so hence, all of us who are near-death experiences, and the fact that we have been able to, as a result of these experiences, remember or be reminded of who we really are. Now, another thing that I would like to address, which is very interesting, because I read a book by a near-death experiencer, Howard Storm, which I had mentioned to you. And he was an avowed atheist, and then he became an avid Christian as a result of his near-death experiences. And you mentioned something in your article. I want to quote this because it's very interesting. It's right along the lines of this thing here. For many, the belief imprint remains with Christian near-death experiences, often seeing this light as Jesus. Even some atheists who did not believe in life after death also think of the light as Jesus because of their belief system is based on no God versus the Christian God and Jesus. When it is clear in after-death mode that the atheist view is flawed, they switch to believing that the Christian story must be true. This is exactly what happened with Howard Storm. He had a near-death experience, and all of a sudden he became a Bible-thumping fundamentalist Christian when prior to his experience he had been an avowed atheist. Now, another interesting thing that happened was when he was in hospital, he left his body, and there's two points I want to make here. The first point is that he's being drawn down into this hellish, very unpleasant realm. He didn't even know that he was dead, okay, or that his body was dead. So that was an interesting point right there. But then he had a hellish experience with these nasty entities, which to me was really obvious were the reptilians on the lower astral plane in the lower fourth dimension. But then all of a sudden, because these entities were biting at him and grabbing at him and doing all of these things, that he had the sensations of this pain and being violated by them, all of a sudden he starts calling out to Jesus. And here's an atheist, right? And he's suddenly calling out to Jesus because he sees a light. The light comes closer and closer and closer to him, and he still perceives that as Jesus, and he is suddenly carried out of this hellish realm into a very loving realm. And a lot of people will say, well, this is what happened during my near-death experience, so this must be true. And people have asked me, well, which is right? And I say, they're all right, because they're all coming still from different vantage points or perspectives, as you're pointing out, David. But also what I've seen is that there are different dimensions, there are different, how do I say, even compartments within dimensions that people are experiencing during a near-death episode, but also what they believe in or what their frame of mind is also going to have an effect on what they experience and where they go to during a near-death state. So how would you address this? Because I think it's very interesting, and I think it's also important that people realize that all of these are valid, but maybe we can put them into perspective of what's really going on here. Do you have something you want to say about that?
Well, I think it's very simple, really, and you go back to what I was saying earlier about the fact that when we're in embodiment, if you like, the reality is being decoded through a very small filter, which we call the body. And then when you leave the body, that decoding still goes on, but from another perspective. However, the power of programming that the experience in this reality can imprint upon the lower levels of consciousness, that the eternal level of us, can be very, very powerful. And if you take the example within this reality of the stage hypnotist, implants a belief system into the stooge on the stage. And the stooge then starts decoding reality based on the implanted belief. So I've used this example many times, where I've been to stage shows, the hypnotist stage shows, different places as part of my research. And you see people on the stage, they're smelling things, they're tasting things, they're seeing things that aren't actually there. But the senses are passing, for instance, the taste of a potato, which the person is holding, to the brain. And in normal circumstances, the brain would decode that electrical signal into the taste of what we call a potato. But because the hypnotist has implanted into the brain a program which says you are eating an apple, the brain does not decode in the normal way. It decodes in the way that it creates the taste of an apple in line with the program, and the person's tasting an apple even though they're eating a potato. Now, when we leave the body, that process of decoding continues, just in another higher form. And if you are still imprinted, especially in that initial period of leaving the body, when I guess it can be confusing to people who have no idea what's happening. To those who are aware of what happens, leaving the body and death becomes much easier. But that decoding process continues. And if you have that imprint of believing either in no God or the Christian God, and that's what most people in the West do.
Yes.
I mean, my father, for instance, he rejected religion from a very early age. He was in the medical corps during the Second World War in the Middle East, and then he moved up with the troops through Italy as the Allies went northwards. And he saw abject poverty in places like Naples, all around fantastically wealthy churches who were still taking money from the poor in those circumstances to fund the church. And he rejected religion completely. But what he did was throw the baby out with the bathwater, because he equated religion with life after death. And so he rejected life after death as well at the same time. The two were the same to him, because that's the way it was basically presented to him during his life. So you get a lot of atheists who are anti-religion, but if they come from a country where the dominant religion is, say, Christianity, then whether consciously or subconsciously, they do move into this mode of there's no God, but if there is a God, then it's the Christian God, because that's the version of God that they're being given, and Jesus and all the rest of it. So when they have a near-death experience and they don't go into they start to realize that they're alive after leaving the body. So the first one's gone, the old atheism of level of there is no life after death. Well, that's a goner, so they've got to rethink that. And so when they then start to experience this light, this love, they then decode it. We're decoding reality in and outside the body all the time.
Yes.
And they're decoding that light, that love, to fit what they think is the alternative to no God, and that is the Christian version of God. And, you know, I've talked to, you know, and read about different near-death experiences. It's a very interesting subject because it is so important, the near-death experience that so many people have had. It is so, so important to human understanding because these are people who've been there, seen it, and come back to tell the tale. And you know, a number of them have talked about and written about the fact that they have experienced Christian heavens and Hindu heavens and Jewish heavens and stuff. And these are invariably the people who were fundamentalists in their religion while in embodiment, and they're so imprinted by that reality that when they leave the body, they decode reality to fit the belief system. Even then, there's that great line, death is no cure for ignorance, nor is it. If you are still holding a belief system when you leave the body, then you are going to continue to decode reality to fit that belief system, just as you were within the body when you were decoding reality to make the Christian religion be the truth, or the Jewish religion be the truth, or the Hindu religion being the truth. And you know, so this is a reason why it's very beneficial to get some kind of understanding of the mechanism of life and what we are, and of the illusion of death, while we're actually in this reality, because it makes the transition so much easier. Because in effect, what you're doing is you're leaving the body floating on a blank sheet of paper without a structure for what you're going to experience, and you just flow with the experience and you see the experience as you experience it, rather than creating a preconceived idea manifesting as a decoded reality, which is just another illusion.
And I think that's so vitally important, and that's a huge part of this work here, because when... You know, when people are locked in these beliefs, and it really blows me away when I share about my NDEs. And of course, there are a number of us who had what I refer to as more neutral, that they were not colored by religion. I just experienced, in fact, I wasn't even hovering around my body. I could care less about this physical body. I just took off. And it was amazing just to feel this beautiful, totally accepting, loving presence all around me.
One other point that I would make with regard to all this is that the Jesus figure that is claimed to exist, although it's just another version of a story that goes back thousands of years before Christianity, with the hero in the story being different names depending on which part of the world and which culture the story was told. I mean, the gospel stories are the basic theme of them are told thousands of years before in different parts of the world, using, like I say, different heroes and different historical time settings. But what did this Jesus supposed to look like? I mean, nobody knows. They think they know what Jesus looked like because of Renaissance painters and such like who painted versions of how they perceived Jesus to look. Absolutely no one has any idea. I mean, I would say the guy is an illusion. It's just a story, another version of the story. But let's say the guy existed. No one knows what he looked like. I mean, you know, the information about him is so sparse. No one knows what he looks like. And yet, and this is the point I'm making, when people go into a near-death state and they, quote, see Jesus, what do they see? They see the version of Jesus in Renaissance paintings, etc. That's what they see.
And
why? Because that's their belief. That's their belief in what, quote, Jesus looks like. And so that's what they decode into a holographic experience, which is they're decoding an energy field into a form that they relate to as a result of the imprint of programming and belief during physical embodiment. And so they see the classic Jesus, which is just the figment of the imagination of the painters, centuries and centuries after the guy was supposed to exist. And that's just an example of the way that a belief system can manifest as something we think we're experiencing.
I think it's very interesting, too, how they'll even, one person will say, gosh, it was quite amazing that he had blue eyes, and somebody else will say he had brown eyes. One thing that has come to my mind is that it seems that the, for lack of a better word, the human ego needs a humanoid figure to deify, to identify with, something that is so-called tangible to them. Whereas,
that's correct.
You know, what I experienced was just light. It was love. It wasn't some humanoid form, because I don't need a humanoid form. All I needed was that love, and that's what I experienced, and that's what I experience now. But I think it's such a big point of this is to help people understand that when we can realize that we are indeed infinite consciousness, that, what do you know? Consciousness does not cease to be when we lose our bodies. It's just like shedding an old piece of clothing or putting down an old computer, as you say, that it just doesn't work anymore. What do you know? We're still conscious. We're still alive. We can still create anything we want just with a thought, or be anywhere we want just with a thought, or see anyone we want to just with a thought. So it's a powerful point here about how, you know, infinite and powerful we really, really are.
Yeah, and you know, what you were saying about form and people needing a form to identify with because of the imprint of the programming here, this is when people leave the body and they see, formerly dead relatives, as they are perceived, in different forms that they recognize as the former husband or former father or whatever. That's not what those people look like now, because they've left the physical form
exactly.
That took that expression. But when the consciousness leaves the body, obviously in a confused state because it's forgotten who it is, and what it is, and it is just having the experience of remembering, then if the formerly past relatives or whatever projected themselves as mere energy, mere consciousness, then the dying, consciousness leaving the body would have no recollection, would have no connection, would have no perception of what they were interacting with or who they were interacting with, and so they project themselves in the images in the Matrix movies. There's the first movie. There's a point where one of the characters talks about residual self-image, where you project yourself as you were in physical embodiment, even though you're just now consciousness with, in effect, no form. And so it allows the consciousness leaving the body to recognize what it's and who it's interacting with, because they are recognizing them as they were in human form. It's just a projection. That's all it is.
Exactly.
When we leave the body, we are just energy. That's what we are. And we can then project ourselves in any form we choose to do so. We can be in any form or no form, you know, because consciousness in its prime state is just a blank canvas. And imagination paints the picture, then wipes it and paints another one. It's just extraordinary. That's not just, in terms of our own projection of self, if you like. It's also in terms of the landscape and the world that we experience. We paint a picture and then we can wipe it away and paint another one. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to comprehend this for the vast majority of people, completely understandably, because we are so used to experiencing a realm of limitation, a world of I can't, because it's so physical and so dense. It has the feeling, as we decode it, as being very hard, solid, immovable, and kind of permanent, when actually it's just an illusion we're creating. That the only solidity exists in our decoding process, not in actually the reality of what we are living amongst.
You made such a wonderful point too, David, and it's so interesting. I mean, pretty much verbatim in my article, The Dying Process from an Experiencer's Perspective, I even bring up the point, for example, I'm a medium, and talking about deathbed visions as you just were addressing, I actually made the point that as a medium, when we're seeing people on the other side, I have said verbatim, that's not what they look like. They're just projecting themselves as a hologram strictly for the sake of recognition. And interestingly, when somebody crossed over in Nashville, I had just gotten a phone call that he had just crossed over. And I was sitting at my desk taking it all in, and I said, all right, lad, what do you look like now? Not what your body looked like, but what do you look like now? And I got out my pencil. What I do is I use a black mat board or black paper, and I use a white or silver pencil because it's more like drawing light. And I drew this beautiful image, and it was very much like I experienced myself whilst on the other side. I didn't have a body like arms, legs, a head, neck, and all of that stuff, torso. I was more like a bubble, a luminous bubble that looked maybe like a jellyfish or inverted water drop. Just these beautiful, intricate formations of light. Well, this is what my associate looked like, who had just crossed over from the other side, and I gave that drawing to his wife, and she was very, very moved by that. So it's interesting to make this point out, because it's so true. They're just projecting these forms that we recognize, because of course once we leave the physical plane, we're not going to have that form, and when the soul decides to reincarnate again, it's going to take on a completely different form. I think it's just sort of like making clay or something, you know. All right, what are we going to paint or mold or sculpt this time around? And I so appreciate you making out this point here. I wanted to ask you, too, if you had any more, first of all, see if you've got any more engagements coming up that you would like to share. I know that your engagement at the Brixton Academy is sold out. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's quite a barometer, really, of the way things are changing and the way minds are opening and the way the intellect is starting to have to come out with its hands up in so many more people. Because 2,500 people sold out 3 months in advance. When not that long ago, you know, in the 90s, late 90s, I was still talking to nobody. I was talking to 8 people in Chicago once, I remember. And I was talking in little halls and to not many people and lots of empty chairs. And then suddenly, bang, it started to explode. And it's a real barometer of the way people are waking up, because there's no doubt, in my mind anyway, that there is a vibrational change going on, which may relate to the 2012 Mayan calendar, which talked about the end of one energetic age and the start of another one.
Right.
I'm sure they're connected, at least in theme. And this energetic change is teasing more and more people open. We live in like a bubble. I symbolize it in my books as an eggshell. We live in a bubble that is basically the intellect and the lower mind, body consciousness. And this bubble, this energetic bubble, keeps out our awareness of the full magnitude of the infinity that we are. And when we are encased in the bubble and we are perceiving reality through the bubble, we see things in terms, and ourselves, in terms of limitation. And basically, we're decoding reality through the five senses, and not much more. When the bubble bursts or starts to break up, suddenly we are moving our point of observation to a much greater range of consciousness than we were before. And we start to be able to perceive and conceive of things that we would have dismissed while in bubble mode. And I'm seeing this change happening in more and more and more people. And it's a wonderful thing to behold, because it's not just, oh, you know, people are listening to in your information, or that's by the by. What's happening is they're setting themselves free of limitation. They're setting themselves free of I can't and I'm little me. And they're starting to realize the full magnitude of who they are and who everyone is. And so it's a great thing to observe and to see. And it's only going to go on happening. And we are in a situation now where the awakening is putting into panic more and more blatantly the forces of control and suppression. They are now desperately running around like headless chickens, trying to impose as many Orwellian laws and Orwellian levels of surveillance and microchipping and all this stuff to try to keep the lid on this awakening, which they're within the shadow people that you never see, that I could actually control the Bushes and the Blairs and the people. They are completely aware of this energetic transformation that's taking place. It could well be that what we call global warming or climate change is also an expression of this energetic change that's going on. It's certainly not caused by human-made carbon pollution, which is another scam, and quite provably so. It's the temperature is changing. Stands back in amazement. It couldn't be, could it? Because of increased radiation from the sun. Increased radiation from the sun, it affects Earth temperature. Isn't that staggering? Who would have believed it?